Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nancy Altman, co-director of Social Security Works, who assesses President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet nomination for Health and Human Services Secretary and the long-term GOP objective to privatize Medicare and Social Security. Cassidy Fenley, communications coordinator with the group organizing the January 21st Women's March on Washington, who talks about the objectives of the historic march, challenging President-elect Trump's agenda. And Johanna Ruprecht of the Land Stewardship Project, who discusses the successful campaign to ban frack sand mining in Minnesota's Winona County, the first such restriction in the state. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Colombia has ratified a revised peace deal with the leftist Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, ending 52 years of civil war, which has killed 220,000 and displaced 8 million people. It was a landmark victory for Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos, who revived a modified peace plan only weeks after voters narrowly rejected an earlier peace agreement with the FARC. Still, many obstacles stand in the way of implementing the peace agreement. The treaty calls for a six-month process of demobilization and disarmament of FARC rebels, while allowing the rebel movement to form a legal political party. The conservative opposition in Congress, led by former President Alvaro Uribe, walked out of the debate on the treaty before it was approved by a vote of 130-0. Uribe's allies are expected to campaign against the treaty during the 2018 presidential election. In the short term, the Colombian Congress must pass an amnesty law, which would free about 2,000 FARC soldiers from prison before FARC leaders say they will demobilize. The Santos government has sought a court order to speed up adoption of legislation and constitutional amendments to begin implementing the peace treaty. Under the agreement, FARC must turn over all its assets, which will be used to compensate victims of the brutal civil war. The outgoing Obama administration is giving the U.S. military new powers for tracking the movement of foreign fighters across the globe as ISIS militants flee war zones in Syria and Iraq. The Joint Special Operations Command, or JSOC, the unit that coordinated the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, will gain independent authority to deploy its forces globally to track ISIS fighters. JSOC will also be able to provide intelligence and strike recommendations to U.S. allies. The Obama administration has now listed al-Shabaab, the al-Qaeda affiliate in Somalia, as a national security threat under the rules that authorized U.S. military action after the 9/11 attacks. The new authority allows U.S. commanders to increase airstrikes and counter-terror operations in Somalia, which are now often carried out by African Union or Somali government troops. In the days after the 9/11 attacks, Congress gave the U.S. military limited authority to engage in military action against al-Qaeda and affiliates. However, over time, the Obama administration had expanded the application of this use of force resolution. In March, U.S. commanders launched a massive airstrike in Somalia, which killed more than 150 people. The Pentagon said the attack was ordered against al-Shabaab fighters who were planning a raid on an African Union base where U.S. soldiers were stationed. The enormous death toll raised internal questions, officials said, about whether the self-defense exception in the 2013 rules had become a loophole permitting more unconstrained warfare. As standard 40-hour-a-week jobs have disappeared, there's a growing contingent workforce where people work under short-term contracts. This so-called alt-labor workforce is now so large that it accounts for virtually all job growth in the U.S. since 2005. According to the Christian Science Monitor, of the 9 million jobs created over the last decade, only 6% were full-time jobs. The rest were temp, on-call, contract, or freelance work. These same trends have swept across Europe, ripping apart traditional concepts of the social contract that had for decades included benefits such as health insurance and pensions. Contrary to myth, most independent workers are 55 and older and more likely to use traditional ways of finding new jobs rather than using online methods. Many contingent workers value their freedom and flexible schedules, even though they're usually paid less an hour than salaried employees. The growth of alt labor could reinforce the inequality already on the rise in U.S. and European nations. For example, U.S. workers who sign up for jobs at Amazon's Mechanical Turk rarely make more than $8 an hour, according to a recent study. Most made less than $5 an hour, which is less than minimum wage. The online service allows people to sign up to do jobs that can last as little as a few minutes. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
When Donald Trump campaigned for president, he advocated many long-held conservative views, including opposition to immigration reform, climate change denial, big tax breaks for the nation's wealthiest citizens, repealing Obamacare, lifting regulations on corporations and banks, and pouring billions more dollars into the U.S. military. But there were a handful of issues where Trump departed from the conservative orthodoxy, like his opposition to free trade agreements that had been supported by Republican and Democratic presidents alike. In discussing domestic social safety net issues, Trump warned in an April 2015 television interview that his GOP primary rivals would cut Medicare and Social Security, but that he alone would protect those popular programs. But the president-elect's nominee to head the Department of Health and Human Services that oversees Medicare, Congressman Tom Price, Republican of Georgia, sends a very different message. Price is a strong supporter of a plan to raise the Medicare eligibility age and partially privatize the senior health care program. If the Senate approves his nomination, Price will have an ally in GOP House Speaker Paul Ryan, a longtime advocate of Medicare privatization, who has unsuccessfully proposed many plans to shift Medicare from the current single-payer system, in which health care bills are paid directly by the government, to a system where seniors would be forced to use their government benefits to buy private insurance. Vice President-elect Mike Pence is another powerful member of the incoming Trump administration who supports privatizing Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Your reporter spoke with Nancy Altman, co-director of the group Social Security Works, who talks about the prospects that Donald Trump will break his campaign pledge and move quickly to privatize Medicare and Medicaid while the Republican Party is in full control of all three branches of government.
Everyone should have their ears be listening for the euphemisms, because these are extremely successful programs, they are extremely efficient programs, and they are extremely popular programs. In every generation, there have been those who hate government, don't think this is Social Security and Medicare are kinds of programs government should provide. They think it should just be, you know, an Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and nothing else, and no domestic spending. So they are against these kinds of government-sponsored insurance. And they used to, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, they'd call it socialism. They'd say that the government shouldn't be doing this. And they, time after time, lost because the American people disagreed. But it was an honest debate. Now, Paul Ryan and Tom Price, the nominee to be Health and Human Services Secretary, Mike Pence, and the others talk about, we want to give people choice. Well, there already is choice within these programs. We want to save them. They're going bankrupt. They are not going bankrupt. Whenever you project out 10, 20, 30, 40 years, Social Security and Medicare are projected out 75 years, 75 years. You're sometimes going to see unintended surpluses. You'll sometimes find unintended shortfalls. And you, of course, you have to address those. And it is true that Social Security and Medicare, if you project out far enough, are forecasting manageable shortfalls, nothing to be alarmed about. We should make the wealthiest pay more into these programs, and these programs will be fine for many generations. There's no reason we can't have these programs forever. But by talking about this alarmist language, it's going bankrupt, it's, we've got to make a radical change, the population's aging, we can't afford all of these old people, what you're doing is softening, they're softening the ground to come in and end these programs as we know them and to substitute. In the case of Medicare, what they're talking about is, instead of right now, when you turn 65, you get a Medicare card and you have insurance that you can go to hospitals, doctors, and so forth. What they want to do is give you some money and say, go out on the market, good luck, find yourself some insurance. We know that before Medicare was enacted, most seniors could not find insurance that they could afford, and those that did paid astronomical amounts for the insurance, and that's why we have Medicare. The irony is that Medicare works extremely well, and what the Paul Ryan and his allies are talking about is ironically turning Medicare into Obamacare. Obamacare is better than what we had before, but it's not nearly as good as Medicare. And what we should be doing is lowering the Medicare age, putting in a universal children's program, moving towards Medicare for all. But of course, they're talking about turning the clock back and turning Medicare into what they hate, Obamacare.
The Republicans now control all three branches of government, something that they haven't done in quite some time. What are the prospects for effective opposition to these plans by Paul Ryan and possibly Donald Trump himself, and certainly the advocacy of privatization by his nominated Health and Human Services Secretary, Tom Price? What can the Democrats, what can progressives do to stop these plans from moving forward and materializing?
Well, it is very scary, as you say, but the one good thing about these programs are that they are overwhelmingly supported across the ideological spectrum, so that the conservative base of the Republican members don't want to see these programs cut. So what we've got to do is make sure everyone knows, call your friends, call your neighbors. If you've got friends and neighbors in red states, let them know that there is a threat to Social Security and Medicare, and they should be contacting their representatives and their senators and reminding them that those people work for us. We don't work for them. And they should not be doing things that we don't want done. So if the Republicans are dead set on doing this, they have the ability to do it. But again, they really are going to be crossing their own constituents as well as everyone else. So it's really important to talk to the senators because they're running statewide. But everyone should know that hands off our Social Security, hands off our Medicare.
That was Nancy Altman, co-director of the group Social Security Works and co-author of the book Social Security Works, Why Social Security Isn't Going Broke and How Expanding It Will Help Us All. Find more commentary on the Republican plan to privatize entitlement and social safety net programs by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the hours and days following the November 8th U.S. election that installed Donald Trump as the nation's next president, tens of thousands of angry and disoriented Trump opponents poured into the streets in cities and towns, declaring that the vulgar billionaire was not my president. The overt racism, xenophobia, and misogyny that were key elements in the Trump campaign, as well as the fact that Trump had lost the popular vote to his Democratic opponent Hillary Clinton by more than 2.5 million votes, were factors provoking demonstrations condemning the incoming Trump administration's reactionary agenda. Trump's narrow margin of victory in Midwestern Rust Belt states led to a Green Party-launched recount effort in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Because national polls had predicted a clear-cut win for Hillary Clinton, thousands of her supporters had made plans to attend her expected historic inauguration in Washington, D.C. Now many of those same supporters and thousands of other Trump opponents will be traveling to Washington on January 21st, the day after the Trump inauguration, to be part of what is likely to be the largest protest of a U.S. president on his first day in office in American history. The Women's March on Washington began as a modest idea among a small group of friends, but has now mushroomed into a national effort with organizers in all 50 U.S. states and some cities abroad. Your reporter spoke with Cassidy Finley, communications coordinator with the January 21st Women's March. Here she discusses plans and objectives for the march and the stories of those involved in organizing the event.
The march really began the morning after the election. There was a woman, a grandmother in Hawaii, who emailed 40 of her friends and said, "We have to do something. We have to go march on Washington." And that email got passed around. It hit social media. It started to go viral. And within 24 hours, there were tens of thousands of people who wanted to go do this, who wanted to go have some kind of women's march on Washington. So as this movement grew and as tens and thousands of people started coming to it on primarily on Facebook, the folks who were administering the Facebook pages that were getting all of the signups realized that this was turning into a real thing, and it really needed people to come in and chair it and plan it and do the logistics as any other national mobilization. They reached out to Tamika Mallory, Linda Sarsour, and Carmen Perez to be co-chairs alongside Bob Bland, who is one of the founders of the original Facebook group. And so those are the four women who are co-chairing the march now. So they represent a diversity of backgrounds, diverse women's voices, and really centering the conversation around the importance of women's voices, understanding that women come from different backgrounds and are facing different issues.
What's the essential message of this rally?
Even though the election was the impetus, it was the thing that caused this moment, this movement to begin, it's really not about coming to D.C. to protest President Trump. It's about coming to D.C. to make a statement, a declarative affirmative statement about women's rights. Because the reality is, even if the outcome of the election had been different, we would still be dealing with issues in Congress. The reality is, even if we had a perfect Congress, a lot of us are still dealing with issues in the workplace. So this is really about bringing women together in solidarity for the issues that are affecting us all.
What are some of the critical issues that fit under that rubric, fit under that umbrella of concern to women and by extension to all of us living in the United States?
So I think that so many of us right now are fearing and anticipating the rollback of rights and liberties that we may have taken for granted as, you know, we've progressed to a certain point and this is just how our society is right now. And now we're seeing that's jeopardized, that's really under threat. And so the Women's March on Washington, the National Committee is pulling together a specific policy platform. But in the meantime, I would like to say that we recognize that there are core issues that are specifically women's issues, such as like reproductive rights. But then there are also, because of our intersecting identities, there are a lot of issues that affect women, like, for instance, our co-chair, Linda Sarsour, is a Palestinian American woman. And the issue of Muslim registries and possible like more targeting and surveillance of Muslims is an issue that affects Muslim women. They're worried about their families. They're worried about their children. Another one of our co-chairs, Carmen Perez, is Mexican American and likewise worried about folks who have legal standing to be in this country right now, who may not or who may be forced into deportation camps. You know, these are very real issues that affect women because we have intersecting identities. And so we're very much concerned about human rights broadly in this country.
The rally is not an end unto itself. There is a critical expectation that people won't just come to the rally, be part of it, and go home and do nothing. There must be some kind of way to build in some activities and some structure so people will have something to plug into when they get home to pursue these same defensive measures, as well as being proactive on a lot of the issues that will be addressed at the Women's March on Washington.
As big as this march could be, it's really important that this is not just a flash in the pan. I mean, it's on the first day of the new administration for a reason, because we need to come together and we need to have new relationships, stronger relationships. It's very, very important that we show up in solidarity for each other's movements so that we can actually protect the rights of all women in this country, regardless of their background, of their ethnicity, of their religion, of their sexual orientation, of their gender identity, and many other vectors for discrimination.
That was Cassidy Fenley, communications coordinator with a group planning the January 21st Women's March on Washington. Find links to the event's website to get logistics and transportation information in all 50 states by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A region of rich soil and rural beauty is found in what's called the Driftless Area, where the four states of Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois come together on both sides of the Mississippi River in terrain that was never covered by glaciers. The hard, round grains of sand found in that region are well suited to be used in the oil and gas fracking industries and is thus in great demand. So-called frack sand is a necessary ingredient, along with hundreds of chemicals and untold billions of gallons of water, in the fossil fuel extraction process known as hydraulic fracking. Opposition to frack sand mining has been building in the area for years, and on November 22nd, the first countywide ban on the practice passed in Winona County in southeast Minnesota. The measure is a prospective ban to keep out all future such mining, including several projects that had already been proposed. However, under the legislation, one existing frack sand mine will be allowed to continue operating. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Johanna Ruprecht, policy program organizer with the Minnesota-based Land Stewardship Project. Here she describes the damage frack sand mining has already caused in the region and explains how activists won their campaign.
Particularly in the Driftless Area, southeast Minnesota, western Wisconsin, northeast Iowa, northwest Illinois is a lot of the places where the best sand for the oil and gas industry's purposes happens to be found. It's silica sand. It's very hard, very round. It has the qualities that they want from it in terms of being able to hold open the cracks in the shale to release the oil and gas. And it also happens to be underneath our hills and bluffs and our farmland here in some of the most unique and special areas in terms of biodiversity. The Driftless is really a place unlike anywhere else. So there's a lot of reasons people want to see it protected. The industry really hit the hardest and the soonest in Wisconsin. And because of that, people in Minnesota, just because of the nature of how that happened, we're able to have a little bit of a heads up and see the kinds of impacts it was having on local communities and rural communities and the land in Wisconsin and see that this is something we really didn't want to have happen here.
Can you give some examples of those impacts?
Bluffs being taken down, hills being taken down, really just landscape level change in a way that is never going to be able to be put back. There are many incidents now that have been reported of water contamination from frack sand operations, whether it's not being able to control their wastewater streams, silt and potentially chemical contaminated material getting into neighboring streams or rivers or ponds, lakes, that sort of thing. There's major air quality concerns for people. The sand, it's silica sand, it's well known to be, the dust produced from crushing silica is well known to be a health hazard, especially in industrial settings where people are working with silica sand. There's just really hasn't been sufficient research to determine the level of harm for people living next to those facilities where the sand is being mined and processed and transported. You know, it's a lot of concern about the industrialization of rural areas. For a lot of people, it's absolutely both a concern about these local level impacts and it's the fact of what the sand is going for, that it's to be used in fracking. So we don't want our communities to be complicit in the harm that that's doing to people in other parts of the country. And as well as we recognize it's going to fuel further oil and gas extraction leading to climate change, which obviously impacts all of us. So for all of those reasons, local impacts on our end, the local impacts on the other end, and the global impacts of this industry too. People just feel that it's too extreme to be allowed to happen. And the fact that a few landowners and the corporate interests driving it could make some money off of this doesn't mean that it's something we have to allow. And we were able in Winona County now to say no at the countywide level.
Johanna Kuprecht, what do you think the impact will be of passing this countywide ban when, you know, there are many counties in the four-state driftless area where this frac sand mining is going on?
Well, we certainly hope that this is going to be a precedent for other counties and that other counties would follow suit and pass bans too. And yeah, that's certainly, you know, we're opposed to frac sand mining and we're opposed to fracking too, and anything that can be done to throw a wrench in that and slow down that process. That's, you know, it's not separate issues. It's all connected. This is one end of the harm of extreme energy extraction and what people are feeling in other places like Pennsylvania and Texas, North Dakota, where they have been doing the actual fracking. It's all part of the same issue. So anything that we can do to slow it down, that's good. In terms of the impact it would have, yeah, there would have to be, like, hopefully that's what we do see. There would have to be other counties and other places where the frac sand is found, people standing up and saying no to it. And people have been in Wisconsin, in Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois. People have absolutely been resisting frac sand operations for many years, and a lot of them have been stopped. This is just the first in terms of a countywide ban that anybody has been able to take that step. But we definitely want to see and hope we see more of that happening in other places now, too.
Can you describe a little more how the Land Stewardship Project organized this successful campaign?
Yeah, so Land Stewardship Project organized this campaign. We got our members together, and so it was a 17-month campaign. We've been fighting the frac sand industry for several years before then, and a lot of people have been involved in Winona County, but 17 months ago in June of 2015, we gathered our members and supporters together from different neighborhoods in the county that had been fighting these proposed frac sand operations. People were feeling like, you know, it'd be better if we're able to do something on the countywide level rather than just individually trying to stop each of these operations for the rest of our lives, basically. So people agreed at that time to set a goal of passing a countywide ban, and that's what we've been working on ever since.
That was Johanna Ruprecht, policy program organizer with the Minnesota-based Land Stewardship Project. Learn more about the campaign to ban frac sand mining by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manto, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.